It's really embracing this idea that you're almost a scientist with life as your lab. When you decouple your self-worth from the outcome, and when you focus on running little experiments instead and seeing this as a giant lab, like a playground, a sandbox, then you can see uncertainty as just a very neutral aspect of the experience. As long as you conduct an experiment and you learn something by the end of it, you're winning.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. This podcast is a venue for me to follow my curiosity through conversations with leading thinkers and builders. My guest today is Anne-Laure LeCompte, an ex-Googler, writer and founder at Nest Labs, and a PhD candidate in psychology and neuroscience at King's College in London. We talk about treating life as a series of experiments, mindful productivity, redefining ambition, combining perspectives across domains, and more. Please enjoy. Going back earlier in your life and kind of pre-career, in another podcast episode, I had heard you say that although you had an interest in literature, you felt pushed into science. And now, interestingly enough, you write about neuroscience and psychology, and you're also getting your PhD in it. In hindsight, are you glad that you were pushed into that? And did you develop a love for science, or was it kind of this latent interest that just you had to realize after you were pushed into it?
I think I always loved science, especially now that I know what science actually looks like, when it's not about just sitting in a classroom and listening to someone talking to you and having to memorize facts and then just spill them out again during an exam. And to me, that's what science was like at the time when I was in school, and I really didn't like it. And I loved literature for some of the reasons I love science today, because it was creative. I could ask questions. There were different ways to approach problems. And even comparing the kind of work that we were doing with friends, you could see that we could take the same raw material, like a book or an essay by a philosopher, and we could arrive at different conclusions by looking at different aspects of the so-called data, which wasn't really data. And it's the same with science, where you could have the exact same tools and the exact same data. Depending on what aspect you decide to study, you could discover different things, which is, you know, very interesting. And also, science is not about what I thought it was at the time when I was in school. It's not about just learning facts by heart and just regurgitating them afterwards to try and get a good grade. It is also about asking questions, being curious, playing with ideas, connecting them together, collaborating with other people, etc. So I did end up falling in love with science quite late in life, but I realize now that it's mostly because I didn't know what science was when I was a kid. I don't think that what I was doing in school was science, and that's what I'm doing today. And I'm very fortunate now that I can actually combine two of the things that I love the most, because I'm doing research, I'm doing science, but I'm also writing about it. And so there's still also this aspect of trying to communicate ideas in a way that is clear and engaging to a wider audience, which I really enjoy.
Do you find that writing and research and going through the scientific method, that those are kind of separate skill sets? And how do you go about tapping into each of those, but also balancing them?
They definitely require some different skills, but in the end, if you look at them from a more holistic standpoint, actually you kind of need the full spectrum of skills to both do good science or be a good writer. So we've all seen, for example, scientists that are really good at conducting experiments, but then really bad at communicating the results. You read the paper and you're not quite sure what they're saying. And science, it's a lot about, obviously, you know, and we love those stories of the myth of the lone genius. And there are some very big discoveries in science that have been made by just one person on their own. That's the exception. Most science happens in a collaborative kind of environment where you learn from each other. even when you do a PhD, you spend the first few months just reading what everybody else has done in your field and saying, hey, so that's the gap I've noticed and that's what I'm going to do, instead of just reinventing the wheel all the time. And so I think that in order to be a good scientist, you need to be good at applying the scientific method, conducting robust experiments and making sure they're reproducible, et cetera. Absolutely. But if you want to be able to contribute to science in general, science with a big S, where we're all growing and learning together and building on the shoulders of each other, you also need to be a good communicator and you need to be able to convey your ideas clearly so other scientists can learn and build on top of them. And equally, as a writer, you can have a beautiful, use a beautiful language, use beautiful words. It's very, you know, almost flowery and it's so nice. It sounds nice. And then if you start rereading some sentences, you're like, what is this person saying exactly? Or I don't quite agree, or the argument actually is not that solid. And I do think that in order to be a good writer, you need to be able to convey your ideas in a way that sounds good, but also you need to make sure that the ideas themselves can stand on their own. So it's quite similar and you're taking it from both ways, but I think it's great. Trying to develop that full spectrum skill set, I think is helpful.
On the note of interpersonal communication and collaboration, you have exposure to that through your research day to day through Nest Labs and through the process of writing book. It's a collaboration between you and the editor, among other people. There's a Steinbeck quote that's always resonated with me, which I'm going to butcher it. It's something along the lines of, creation only takes place in the lonely mind of a man. It can be extended by the group, but it starts with the individual. You had just said that you need to be able to work in these collaborative, group-oriented environments. How do you think about where the work needs to be done individually versus you can lean on others to help extend or expand? What's that kind of relationship like?
I think at the ideation stage, when you're trying to figure out what is the question that you want to answer, it's actually really good to build on the shoulders of other people and collaborate with other people. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're actively working with a specific person, but I think you should read as much as you can, or it could be podcast videos, whatever. But that's the amazing thing about books, is that you can actually connect with other authors. And even if, you know, it's like, and you can have that conversation with them. If you take notes, if you read several books about the same topic, if you ask yourself, what is different about what this author thinks about this question versus what this author thinks. So you can create this conversation. So I don't necessarily mean actual physical conversations with another human being in the same room. I just mean more like intellectual connection with other people who have explored those questions before. Because I think it would be quite arrogant to ask a question and think that you're the very first human being ever to have asked that question. Right. What you can do though is, and that's not arrogant, I think, is ask yourself, okay, what's a different way I can approach this? What is my unique perspective that I can bring to approaching this question? But in order to do this, you need to have an idea of what else has been said before you decided that this was interesting to you. So I think at the ideation stage, that it's really good to just make sure that you collect all of that information and you connect those ideas based on what other people have done before you. And then it's nice to retreat a little bit and then focus on your own approach, because that's where you want to add your own original thinking to the idea. So it can be nice in those moments to try and maybe turn down the input a little bit and turn on your own creative output so you see what comes out. And it may not be good at the beginning, but just trying and see like what comes out, what ideas you have. In science, that would probably be maybe running a little pilot, like just trying to see what you get with a small sample. In writing, that could be just writing a rough draft, a rough outline, just trying to, again, see what's there. And then again, it's good at the next stage to bring in other people again And in science, that could be asking your colleagues to review the data with you and see if anything is missing or maybe tweaking the protocol. In writing, that's when you can maybe send a first draft to someone and say, hey, what do you think? AD ideas, etc. And so I really see it as almost like a creative cycle where you go through that loop and you fluctuate in between the two, you oscillate between the two, and you have alone time and then collaborative time, alone time, collaborative time. And I think if you are always collaborating or always working on your own, you're never going to be able to create something as good as if you make sure to have a bit of both and you try to balance them together.
In order to write a book, and it's the same case when you're writing your newsletter, you have to the point you just made, be able to balance the insights of others with your own unique perspective or voice. What is the voice or perspective you feel like you're adding to the world that's missing?
I am trying at least to bring a more nuanced perspective when it comes to work and productivity. I grew up with a lot of advice that was very rigid in terms of how to manage your time, time blocking, the Pomodoro technique, and a lot of books about willpower, motivation, grit. And it has never really worked for me. I always found that the most important aspect of me being creative and productive was how I felt, my mental health, my mood, my interest in the project. I'm able to work for hours nonstop if I love what I'm doing and I don't feel tired at all at the end. Actually, I feel energized. Whereas you can give me a task that's boring and after 10 minutes, I'll feel like I just worked for 10 hours and it was awful. And I think a lot of people feel this way, but a lot of advice that I was reading was, again, all about motivation, willpower, discipline. And I do think that there's a lot of, there are a lot of things from, a lot of learnings from Stoicism that are very interesting. And I do understand the popularity of these ideas. And there are things that I absolutely believe in, like, you know, just like focus on what you can control and not what you cannot control, etc. But there's also this whole idea of, again, discipline, mastering your willpower, etc., which I think the big reason why these ideas are so popular is because it's very aspirational. People wish they were like this. People wish they could control their emotions. They could master this internal turmoil that we have sometimes when we're not quite sure why we feel anxiety, etc. And they can't because we're human and that's not really how we work. But so they keep on reading this Stoic advice, hoping that maybe one day they'll become this person. So I think the perspective that I'm trying to bring to the table is that it's actually okay that life is a bit messy, that we are a bit messy, and that by embracing this messiness, we can, I think, create better work and be better humans and better connect with each other than if we try to design the perfect productivity system, to be in control, to master our emotions, etc.
As you just mentioned, productivity is a very loaded word nowadays, yet you use on your landing page and throughout your work elsewhere, the phrase mindful productivity, and the operative word is mindful. So how would you differentiate the kind of productivity with a little more like specificity or in terms of tactics? How does it differentiate from traditional productivity?
I would say that traditional productivity is very much outcome focused. It's really about how efficient you are, how well you manage your time. It's using very often speed as a measure of performance, whereas mindful productivity is focused on the present moment and the experience itself of doing the work. And so that's why mindful, like, is the adjective that I'm using, because it borrows a lot from mindfulness and being fully present in the moment, which I think can be applied to work. So instead of trying to do 1,000 things at the same time, just like focus on this one thing that you're trying to do, listen, also just listening to your body. And instead of you know, maybe using a Pomodoro timer or using the data on your Apple Watch to tell you when you should take a break. Maybe just listen to how you feel, because very often your body is really good at telling you when you need a break and you're tired and it would be better to stop working. But we've become really bad at doing this. So that's the big difference in between mindful productivity and traditional productivity, is really this idea of focusing on the present moment and designing your work in a way where the experience of doing the work is as enjoyable as possible. And so everything becomes more sustainable when you do it in this way. And you're probably less likely to burn out. You're also going to be more creative. And you are, I know it's a loaded word, but you are going to be more productive in the end if you think in a more sustainable way like this, rather than trying to pushing yourself through and again using willpower, motivation, timers, and all of that to do your work.
Yeah, I think we've treated productivity as the end instead of a means to an end. And I wonder to what degree that stems from individuals not really knowing what it is they want to be doing or should be doing, such that they have to replace a kind of internal or intrinsic motivation with all of these systems and processes to support them. To what degree is this just a matter of doing the introspective work to figure out who you actually are and what it is you actually want, from which the motivation or the work will naturally flow from? What is that balance between understanding what it is you really want versus building in those processes, those hacks, if you will, to see the work through?
Absolutely. Another topic I write a lot about is metacognition, which just means thinking about thinking. And it's exactly what you're describing, is making space to do the almost meta work of understanding what exactly it is you want. Is the way you're working right now feeling the way it should feel? Is that how you want this to keep on feeling for a very long time? Or is that okay? Because it can be okay. I want to be clear that sometimes work is not enjoyable. And it would be a lie to say that the goal is for work to always be enjoyable, because that, I don't think that that happens. And anyone knows that there will always be some work that you need to do and that you wish you didn't have to do. Taxes is a really good example, but there are little tasks like this, these and things that we don't want to do. So it's really more of a matter of being able to observe how you're feeling, your internal states, and also knowing if that work you're doing that you're not enjoying, and asking yourself first, is that something that I absolutely need to do? Taxes, for example, really no choice, you know, but that's fine because that's a short-term thing. So I'm just going to do it and then we're done. This is not a systemic issue. This is just something that needs to be done right now. Fine. Or if it is something that I'm not fully forced to do, am I okay doing that short-term because I know that this is helping me go in a direction that is important to me? So an example is, let's say that you're going to launch a podcast, for example. You want to launch a podcast. That's something that you're super excited about. There is going to be a part where you need to schedule the calls and you need to, you know, do all of that admin. I've never talked to a podcaster who tells you that that's the part they love.
Right.
But it's the part, it's a part that enables everything that they love, which is talking with the guests, doing the research, learning about all of those different things. And so asking yourself, if is that thing that is not so enjoyable aligned or enabling something that is actually enjoyable? And then in the future, if you like take it another step, is that something that I could automate or not? With podcasting, I don't have a podcast myself, but I asked a friend and he was like, I could technically automate it, but I probably would not get the same guests because it is so important for people receiving an invitation to feel like it's a human being who's actually interested in talking with them. Then they'll answer and they'll talk to me. But if I'm automating it, I can't ask someone to take 1 hour out of their busy day to talk to me if I didn't even take the time to spend 5 minutes crafting an email. So the answer is not always yes. So that's why metacognition is very helpful, is that it's not always going to give you the same answer. It's never going to give you a simple answer, But again, it's the meta work of being aware of exactly how you're feeling, where you're going, and making decisions based on that factual information about your internal states and your aims in life and in work, versus automatically just doing any work to feel like you're making any kind of progress, even if that's not really bringing you closer to anything you want.
Setting aside the category of rote administrative work, I was recently reading one of Paul Graham's essays, and I think it was titled How to Find What You Love or something along those lines. And he talks about exactly what you were saying, that the day-to-day rote tasks, if they are from a macro perspective, in service of some grander outcome or objective you have, then it makes it a little more palatable. And to your point, anything you want in life is going to require some percentage of work you don't really want to do in the moment. But I think we've romanticized this idea of finding your passion such that it feels like it should be, you've only found that thing once you're 100% in love with it. Like every waking moment is obsession, which just isn't the case. And I'm curious, in your own life, if you experienced that or previously thought that, oh, the only way I know I found my thing is if I'm just 100% in love with it all the time. And maybe how has your thinking evolved about identifying the thing that is genuine or authentic to you and you want to do day to day and also for a long time horizon?
I actually used to feel pretty bad about the fact that I didn't have that one passion. I worked in Silicon Valley for a while where we had this collective narrative that any great founder is passionate about that one problem that they want to solve for the world. I think it had actually a name. I can't remember now what it was, but it's, startups were supposed to be mission driven, and the founder was supposed to really eat, sleep, dream, like everything, live their whole life, just like really breathe that idea all the time. And it was supposed to be their one true purpose in life. Anything less than that, and you were not passionate enough about your mission. And I never really had that. I've always been curious about 1,000 different things. And I definitely have the shiny idea syndrome where I hear something new and I'm like, oh, what is that? Oh, that's so cool. Same. Let me go and read about it on Wikipedia. And then I'm like, oh, maybe I should start a blog about this. I'm like, no, I already have a blog. Stop it. Okay. And I just felt like I had to find that one thing in order to really make progress, because at least in Silicon Valley, all of the very successful people seemed like they had that one true passion, and I didn't have that one. I've really come to terms now with the fact that I probably will never have that one true passion, and it's actually completely okay. I have many different interests, and I have many different areas that I'm curious about. And what I do now is that instead of starting a really big project that's supposed to be my one passion, which I did twice, I did two startups before. Okay. And I really tried to follow that one passion and it didn't work out. I just do a bunch of little experiments now. I notice something that I like. First, I write it down and I have a note on my phone. I put it there and I let it sit there for a while. And 90% of those ideas, after maybe a few days, I forget about them. And that's a good sign that probably it's okay to forget, to just not move on with them. But if they keep on bugging me and it's been a few weeks and I can't stop thinking about it, then I'll design a little experiment around it. I call these, I make a pact basically with myself where I'm like, okay, for 1 month, every week, I'm going to publish something about this topic. Or maybe for 2 months, I did that with coding where I was like, for 3 months, I'm going to learn how to code for at least 20 minutes every day. And we'll see at the end of the 3 months how I feel. And so I do that. And usually by the end of those little experiments, I have a good idea if this is something that I actually want to pursue further, or if maybe it was just that little moment of curiosity. that was a lot of fun to explore, but it doesn't necessarily have to become a passion.
I think this process dovetails nicely into your concept of growth loops. And I can let you explain it, but I'll attempt to give a TLDR, which is instead of the traditional perspective around kind of a linear life and career path, you can think about your life both in the micro and the macro as the series of cycles or growth loops, which somewhat mimics the scientific method, but this idea of doing, measuring, learning, and adjusting. You had this excellent little throwaway line, I suppose, in one of your talks. It also appeared on another podcast where you said, ambition is the liminal space between who you are and who you want to be. And so I'm curious how we should think about, maybe you can expand on that and talk about how we should think differently about our relationship with ambition and kind of redefine it.
Yeah, so I consider myself a fairly ambitious person, and I mostly worked with people who feel the same, who want to contribute, have an impact, who want to learn, who have, I think, deep down also a certain fear of stagnation. And so it's not necessarily something that is always positive, like to be ambitious, but I think our definition of ambition has become unnecessarily negative, because we really associate it now with this idea of climbing a ladder in a very linear way with a very specific outcome that you're supposed to reach. And so being ambitious is keeping your eyes on the prize and being really focused on achieving a very specific goal. And again, coming back to you, it's kind of, it all ties together, but going back to that traditional idea of productivity,
right?
Having the willpower, the perseverance, and the grit to keep on climbing that ladder, that mountain that you have in front of you, and to get to that prize. When really ambition can also be understood as, if you just put it in contrast with stagnation, being ambitious is wanting to always be in movement and to maintain momentum, but it doesn't say anything about the direction of that movement. And it doesn't have to be up and to the right. It could be in all sorts of different directions. You can change directions in the middle.
Right.
You can get to a crossroad and turn your head left and feel like, oh, actually, that looks more interesting this way. I'm going to go there. And so that's what I mean by ambition is the liminal space between where you are and where you want to be. It's the idea that being ambitious is wanting to actively explore that space and learning as much as possible about the world, about yourself, contributing to shaping that space, but also knowing that at any point in the process, where you want to be can change, because you are going to learn, you are going to grow, you are going to become a different person. And so you don't have to be obsessed with one specific outcome. The only ambition you should have is, again, to learn and to grow and to contribute in ways that you don't necessarily have to know what they look like today. And actually, it would be really boring if you already knew what they look like today. You want to look back and feel like, oh, wow, I can't believe I'm here. And I can't believe I went through this journey. That's how you want to feel.
I found in my own life, and I've seen this in other people, that part of the difficulty of what you're describing is living in that liminal space. It's almost a space of uncertainty, and for some that manifests as fear. How you might recommend other people embrace that space of uncertainty and discomfort, understanding that there's something great on the other side of it?
I definitely think, as I mentioned, that movement is a key to feeling better about that space of uncertainty. Because even if you don't know where you're going, you can at least have a little bit of control over the questions you ask and the experiments that you run. And it's really embracing this idea that you're almost a scientist with life as your lab. When a scientist runs an experiment, they don't know what result they're going to get. So you never look at the result being like, oh no, that failed. Like, that's a failure. It's not the outcome that I wanted to get. You may be surprised by the outcome, but you're not going to feel like a failure because the hypothesis that you formulated was not validated by the results. You may be surprised. And your reaction as a scientist should be, oh, okay, wow, we learned something. That's super interesting. Let's use that data and see how we can design another experiment to dig a little bit further and try to understand what's going on here. And so when you decouple your self-worth from the outcome, and when you focus on running little experiments instead and seeing this as a giant lab, like a playground, a sandbox where you can try things, then you can see uncertainty as just a very neutral kind of like aspect of the experience, which is completely fine. And it doesn't mean that you're failing. You, as long as you conduct an experiment and you learn something by the end of it, you're winning. That's all you want. There's movement, you're learning, you're growing. And the only thing that is not going to change is that you don't know where you're going. But you also don't know where you're going when you're following a linear way of thinking right. about life. Great you just point. Have the illusion of knowing where you're going. So you're just being a little bit, you're walking through life with your eyes a bit more open than someone who's following a linear path.
Yeah, there's almost self-delusion in either path. But when you kind of externalize things or you pull yourself out of the path that you're on, maybe a bit more aimless path, it allows you to sit with that uncertainty a little bit more and treat it a bit more like a game. And I suppose everything comes back to the stories and game, the stories we tell ourselves and the games we play. That it also reminds me of a quote from I had another podcast previously around the future of learning and work. And one of my guests, Ruben Harris, said, always view your life as if you're in beta, which you could probably resonate with as a former tech person. But it's that same sentiment. One of the challenges I've found when it comes to ambition, at least as it's traditionally been defined, is... and this also goes back to Stoicism, is this balance between contentment or satisfaction and ambition. And so I'm curious how your kind of model or framework accounts for or doesn't this need for contentment versus always moving and striving for something else.
Yeah. I think once you remove the idea of getting to a specific destination, it removes a lot of that struggle with dissatisfaction with where you are, with the sense of lack that you may be experiencing because you feel like something's missing. Once you remove that, it really helps you with accepting the fact that things are not always perfect. And I always tell people that the goal is not to be always content or satisfied or happy. Do you have this like very stable emotional state? Because that's absolutely impossible. There are going to be so many factors, whether external or internal, like conscious or unconscious, things that you can't control that are going to impact how you feel, that it is impossible to strive for this perfect equilibrium. Nobody is able to do this. And I actually think there's added suffering in trying to achieve that perfect equilibrium that is impossible to achieve because we feel like, oh, why can't I do this? And other people seem to be able to do it. Absolutely, almost nobody, like maybe some Buddhist monks somewhere are able to do that. But right. You know, you and I and most people, I don't think when you don't make it your main goal, like I don't think it's possible. And so instead, what you want is to aim for manageable fluctuations. So instead of going from completely manic with happiness and because something crazy happened that lasts for maybe one day and then you wake up the day after and you feel like, oh my god, life sucks now, there's no meaning, etc., and being depressed, you just want to have like little fluctuations where there are going to be some days where you're a little bit more excited and some days are a bit less exciting. And there are going to be days where you're very happy and days where you're going to be very sad because something happened. And you almost want the average of these to be at that mythical baseline, right? Knowing that you will never stay on that baseline ever. It's just, you want the oscillations to be as close as possible. And embracing these, I feel like, is also a big part of enjoying life in general, because it is part of the ups and downs. Like this, I think, I can never remember who said this. It does sound like an Oscar Wilde quote, but it could be Aldous Huxley. I don't remember. But the quote says something like, the only completely consistent people are dead. The people who are dead. So you don't want to be completely consistent. You want to have those fluctuations.
Right. Oh, that's a great quote. One of the other challenges I've experienced in my own life, and I imagine others have as well, with this idea of the growth loop or the idea of the growth loop, but also operating in this kind of liminal space, is understanding when to continue with that growth loop versus kick off another one. And so I'm curious what the signs or indicators or feelings are for when you should exit that growth loop, reassess, and kick off a new one.
I think the main question, and it only works really if you do have a regular metacognitive practice where you look at how you're feeling, because if you just sit and wait for you to know if you should keep on going or not, you could wait for a long time and just feel unsure about it. So that's why it's good to regularly reflect on how things feel and where you're going. And to me, one of the main indicators is how much you have to rely on motivation and forcing your motivation to get things done. If you keep on doing things because you feel this natural momentum, things happen that make you discover more things, that make you connect with more people, that make you feel like, oh, let's try this, let's do that. And you know, that's what happened for me with Nest Labs. It started with this little newsletter, and then someone was like, can I sponsor the newsletter? I was like, sure. And I was like, actually, I hate that, but I still love the newsletter. So maybe let's do something that is more community-based and let's build this. Okay, that's great. Let's do this, etc. And you have this momentum, and I have no idea where I'm going with Nest Labs, but every week there's something happening that fuels my curiosity and where I feel like, oh, I want to explore this path. Let's have a look here. And so that's why I know I can keep on going, because there's this natural momentum that is embedded in the project and the connection I feel with that project. If for a while, when you're doing that regular practice, you notice that you have to rely on motivation, you have to motivate yourself, you have to say, okay, one more week, let's just do this, one more week, let's do that. And you're trying to really using, again, willpower and discipline to try and force yourself to do something, that is a really good sign that you should reconsider the project. Sometimes it's the project itself, you're not inspired anymore. Sometimes it's the way you're doing the project. So for Nest Labs, again, for example, I realized at some point that I was starting to dread logging into the community that I had built, that online private community, because every time I logged in, I had so many private messages from people and I had to go through them, and it felt like admin work, basically just replying one by one to all of those messages. And it made me doubt whether I should keep on going with having this community, because that's not a feeling that you want to have. And not with a lot of people that you actually really enjoy talking with, but I had every morning, I was like, okay, I started blocking time again, which is a very bad sign for me, saying, let's do half an hour of answering those messages. And then I realized that it's silly. Now it feels obvious, but it's because all of the messages, support messages, like I can't log in, I lost my password, my credit card didn't work, etc. And the other ones where it was like, I read this article, super cool, I think you'll love it, they were all arriving in the same inbox. And so I had to deal with all of them, and it was all mixed together, and it just felt like this mountain of work. And I, even when I opened the nice, interesting messages, I had no energy, and it still felt mechanical. And sometimes, you know, I was just like, oh, great, thank you for sharing. But it just, it didn't feel good. So what I did is that I separated this. We created a separate email address, and I hired someone to help me with just support tickets, things that I don't add any value there. It's really just, you know, you're logged out of your account, etc.
Right.
And since then, I've found again that joy of logging into the community and talking with people, because all of the messages I get are interesting. So it's just, it's a very simple example of that shows that it's not always the project itself, but you need to think about it, and you need to ask yourself that question to figure out if you want to keep going, and if you want to keep going as is, or if maybe some changes are needed.
In the way in which you describe it, there's absolutely a lot of thinking or the metacognitive aspect of it. But it also comes across as a very kind of felt understanding of what it is you want to do. Like you're really going off of, do I enjoy this or not? Is this fun? Do I feel good about this? Which I think on one hand is not surprising given your interest in writing and neuroscience and psychology. You kind of toe these two lines between the creative and the more practical, if you will. Or rational. How have you found in your own life and work the balance between those two perspectives, or should we not view it in this kind of bifurcated way? And in fact, there's a lot more unification there than we historically have thought.
Ooh, I think in general, that's probably an answer you can give to a lot of similar phrased questions, is that very often when we think that two things are completely binary, they usually aren't. And I think that's the case here also. It's just a different way to, it's different ways to look at similar questions. And so if you look at the scientific aspect, we're really trying to understand almost at a mechanical level, what is going on in the brain, what is going on in the body. And that's really interesting, because we want to understand how the world works and how we work and how our minds and bodies are built. And that's great. That being said, that knowledge is very often not directly applicable to making decisions in your daily life. And it's just knowing which neurotransmitters are firing, which neurotransmitters are involved in the way I feel, are not necessarily going to help me know that when a friend is telling me about their problems, there are situations where they don't want me to give them a solution. They just want me to listen. I can read all of the books about neuroscience or do all of the research in neuroscience. That's not going to help me with that particular situation. Yeah. And so I think it's just important to know what perspective you're taking to answer what different kind of questions. And it goes back to a bit of, you know, what we talked at the beginning, where even in science, a cognitive scientist, a psychologist, a neuroscientist, a philosopher, they may look at the exact same question and come with different answers. They're all absolutely valid and absolutely useful, because they're all bringing a perspective that can be applied in different situations depending on an angle. And again, you can't take the neuroscientific perspective and just slap it on everything and here's your answer, right? So I think they're all very useful. And for the most complex questions, it's great sometimes to combine several of these perspectives when you're asking questions about life, about what it is to be human, about relationships, about love. It is usually it's impossible. And again, it would be really arrogant for any kind of research field to think that they have the one answer to those big questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this theme. And I think you touched on the tentative answer that I've arrived at. One of the themes I've been wrestling with and has cut across this entire podcast is viewing things in this dualistic way, but then realizing that there actually is a more integrated perspective there. It's complex, but it isn't, you know, these different siloed perspectives. in closing, there's always one question I ask all guests, which is, what's one question you would leave me and listeners with to think about or act on?
What will your next experiment be?
That's a perfect, it's a perfect marriage of everything we've been talking about here. I love it. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. This is a lot of fun, and looking forward to reading your book when it comes out later this year.
Thanks so much.